episode 52 of The Infectious Myth. I'm David Crow. If you have a comment during the show, you can call 888-874-4888. Afterwards, you can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us on facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. And if you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. A word about PRN. You probably know that it's been an incredibly difficult time for them with their studio becoming basically unlivable and having to find new space, move into it, the website crashing, all that kind of stuff. So now is a good time to support this network. If you want to continue to listen to innovative and edgy programs, then open your wallet a little bit and support PRN.fm. It's been a couple of months since the Charlie Hebdo massacre, so I wanted to talk a little bit about freedom of speech if the topic hasn't gone out of style. And first of all, I'd like to say, although maybe I don't need to say this, that a massacre of anybody is something that has to be condemned. I think one of the problems with the whole Charlie Hebdo episode is it became a situation of you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. I don't think there are too many people, except for a few fundamentalist jihadists, who really thought that walking into an office and killing people because they were drawing pictures that you didn't like was in any way justifiable. But the fact that the cartoonists were murdered doesn't turn the cartoonists into saints. And so I was very uncomfortable with the choice of I'm either je suis Charlie Hebdo or I'm with the terrorists. In a situation like this, I used to do a lot of computer programming, and we'd draw a little table, and we'd have for Charlie Hebdo, against Charlie Hebdo, for the terrorists, against the terrorists. And so that gives you four choices. You can either be for Charlie Hebdo and for the terrorists, which is obviously absurd. You can be against the terrorists and for Charlie Hebdo, which is where most of the world has sat in. Or you can be against the terrorists and against Charlie Hebdo because of their practice of attacking what is a relatively weak group in France, which is the Muslim population, which occupies largely the lower portion of the economic strata. It's a lot easier to attack them than it is to attack rich people, powerful politicians, Jewish people, even black people. It's no longer acceptable to attack them. But anything goes with Muslims because there really is a war between Christianity and Muslims that's been going on since the time of the Crusades and ramped up with with the two President Bush's wars on Iraq. The world becomes greatly simplified. You're either with us or you're against us. Of course, the world's a whole lot more complicated than that, and we now see that in Iraq, where America is opposed to ISIS, and many of the logical allies in the fight against ISIS are people like the Iranians. And so sometimes the enemy of my enemy is my enemy, but my friend, it gets really complicated when you're trying to solve problems by dividing the world into good and evil. Charlie Hebdo came across as this brave organization that would never stop at criticizing anybody. But there was a very interesting event that happened in the year 2009 at the Charlie Hebdo magazine when a writer wrote a very mild comment that was interpreted as anti-Semitic. So from the Telegraph, the newspaper in England from 2009, Maurice Siné, 80, who works under the pen name Siné, faces charges of inciting racial hatred for a column he wrote last July in the satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo. The piece sparked a summer slanging match amongst the Paris intelligentsia and ended in his dismissal from the magazine. L'affaire Ciné followed the engagement of Mr. Sarkozy, that's the son of then-President Nicolas Sarkozy, to Jessica Sabowan-Darty, the Jewish heiress of an electronics goods chain. Commenting on an unfounded rumor that the president's son planned to convert to Judaism, Ciné quipped, quote, "He'll go a long way in life, that little lad," end quote. A high-profile political commentator slammed the column as linking prejudice about Jews and social success. Charlie Hebdo's editor, Philip Val, asked Ciné to apologize, but he refused, exclaiming, "I'd rather cut my balls off." So here we have an example of an incredibly minor comment that I wouldn't even consider to be anti-Semitic, but maybe I'm not sensitive enough, and yet the writer got fired from Charlie Hebdo for refusing to reverse it. There are, in fact, many things in France that you can't talk about. There is a black comic in France who's got into trouble because he has created a sardonic salute, I mean, among other things, a sardonic salute that some people think is reminiscent of Hitler. Is it sarcasm or is it Nazism? It is especially difficult when that man is a comedian and the comics in Charlie Hebdo are supposed to be funny. How do you distinguish between what is legitimate satire and what has to be forbidden? Especially in France, the context of the Muslims is very complicated and goes back a long way in history. It's not that long ago that France still had colonies in North Africa, most of which had large Muslim populations. And the brutal treatment of France as they were starting to lose their grip on their empire is legendary. And the French torture techniques helped Americans with their torture techniques. So France doesn't have a whole lot to be proud of in places like Algeria. And the Muslims who have come to France to work, to better their lives, to get better jobs, who in many cases are cleaning people's offices and doing the menial work of the country, have not always been accepted with open arms. They're blamed for not assimilating, but it's not clear that white French people want them to assimilate, that they want a dark-skinned Muslim family at the end of their block. The Mohammed cartoons didn't start with Charlie Hebdo. They started in a right-wing newspaper in Denmark. And I've always wondered what the purpose of the cartoons were. They seem to portray ignorant, sexually repressed Muslims versus the liberalism of the West. And it's certainly true that there's a lot of freedom of speech in the West, but we also don't like to look at our own dark side. We don't like to look at the fact that even since colonialism has supposedly ended, the Western countries have been continually interfering in the workings of their former colonies, often destabilizing democratic movements and installing dictators. The current wars in Iraq, I think, is this war number 3 or war number 4? We had the Gulf War around the beginning of 1990. Then there was the Iraq War in 2003. And now we're going back in. It's pretty obvious that everybody by this point should know that this is a war that cannot be won, that seems to have no purpose except there's bad people in Iraq doing bad things because the country's being destabilized, and so we go in and destabilize it more, and it's pretty clear that even if ISIS is routed out, that something possibly even worse will emerge in the future. But in the process of fighting these wars against obviously really nasty people that chop off the heads of journalists and aid workers and, go after other groups such as Iraqi Christians, they're brutal people, and nobody, just like the terrorists who walked into the offices of Charlie Hebdo, nobody can, well, I guess some people can, but nobody with a good conscience can say that ISIS is a good organization that stands for good things. But we can recognize that it arose out of the destabilization of the country that we in the West created, and maybe there could be a little bit of humility in there, that if we keep attacking Muslim countries, we keep strengthening the Muslim jihadists who actually have legitimate reasons to be angry. And a legitimate reason to be angry doesn't imply that you have a legitimate reason to run around shooting people with machine guns or chopping their heads off. But that also doesn't mean that we have legitimate reasons to drop bombs on what often turns out to be a wedding party, or to fire a drone at what may turn out to be a wedding party or something innocent. It doesn't mean that we in the West have the right to blow up a building that contains one jihadist and their family. And at least some of that family are completely innocent of any crimes. After Charlie Hebdo, of course, everybody rallied around Je Suis Charlie, and there was a big march in France. And part of the hypocrisy that was noted by some people is that many opponents of freedom of speech marched with the French. The Saudis had a place, for example, and at the same time, they were flogging a blogger who had made really mild comments about the Saudi government, criticizing the conservatism of the Saudi government, and the blogger was sentenced to 1,000 lashes. My understanding is that the first set of lashes were issued, and they were so physically damaging that they have not yet been able to issue the second set of floggings. What's really remarkable is not just the brutality of the Saudi government, which chops the heads off far more people than ISIS is capable of doing, and for very bad reasons, usually because the people who are convicted are poor immigrants, such as Sri Lankan housekeepers, people like that, people with no friends in the West and no friends in Saudi Arabia, with the inability to buy off the family, which is possible in under Saudi law. Nobody seems to care about that in the West. There is only very muted criticisms when Saudi Arabia executes a bunch more people in public, flogs somebody who was just asking for a little freedom of speech, because, of course, Saudi Arabia is floating on oil. The West wants the oil, and so, therefore, we can't criticize them. But if Saudi Arabia did not have oil and it had a government that for other reasons we did not like, then the criticisms would be all over the place. Another hypocrisy of the whole Charlie Hebdo affair is that France is far from an ideal country when it comes to freedom of speech. In October 24, as part of a suite of anti-terrorism legislation, France implemented an internet blocking regime. Of course, everybody wants to block the internet because a site hosts child pornography or advocates acts of terrorism, but it's pretty easy to slip away from those things, and all of a sudden criticisms of the French state are advocating acts of terrorism, or indicating why countries that are being invaded by the West have the right to resist might be considered advocating acts of terrorism. Ditto with child pornography. It's not always so easy to say what is child pornography or what isn't. There are maybe artistic photographs of children that somebody will say they're pornographic and sexual, and other people will say they're perfectly innocent. And, of course, as time goes on, more and more things will be added to the list of things that you can't talk about on the Internet in France, including some of the things I've already mentioned, For example, you might not be able to say vile things about Jewish people, but it may be possible to say vile things about Muslim people, and maybe after France gets tired of that, they will ban that and allow vile comments about some other group yet to be defined. It almost seemed during the Charlie Hebdo affair that people were asking for absolute freedom of speech. In what exactly would that mean? That would presumably mean that the KKK could set up a website and advocate the lynching of black people who get too big for their boots. That pedophiles could put up websites openly with pictures of adults having sex with children. Graphic photos of people dying in wars or in other places could be posted on the Internet. And it's certainly true that some of this exists in the corners of the Internet, but it tends to be chased off both by governments and by what are called community standards by the big dominant Internet companies like Google, Facebook, Twitter. If you put really obnoxious stuff up, then it may be banned. But it starts to get a little controversial when the question of exactly what is obnoxious and what is not comes up. I'll talk a little bit more about vaccination later. Vaccination and free speech, well, yes, because right now it's very difficult to have free speech with vaccination. You can talk about vaccination all you want as long as you don't talk about adverse effects and lack of effectiveness. So there was some people were suggesting that Facebook should stop people criticizing vaccines on Facebook. So there are a lot of filters on these organizations, although at present there are a lot of controversial issues where they do allow discussion. But it is a slippery slope. But the opposite, let's talk about the opposite of absolute freedom of speech. Obviously, this would be chaos. It would cause societal unrest. I think we know that if there's enough hateful speech against an identifiable group, that somebody will pick up a gun and go kill somebody. So there are jihadist preachers in Islam who like to incite anger in people and justify killings, but there's also white supremacists who like to do the same thing. And in America, a lot of people on the right like to talk about gun rights and about how the evil things about the American state. Even presidential candidate Ted Cruz has said he wants to get rid of the IRS, and that kind of thing activates some people who don't think too much but have a powerful gun to say, well, gee, maybe I should go help Ted Cruz and go kill a few IRS workers or something like that. Words do have consequences, and so if we had absolute freedom of speech, we'd probably also have absolute chaos. And also, even if we're talking about the mainstream media, the mainstream media survives by editorial license. They choose what gets to get published. They choose, therefore, what doesn't get published. Nobody would read the newspaper, whether it's on paper or on your portable tablet. Nobody would read it if it was 1,000 pages long, just filled with whatever had happened that day. Photos of people dying in war, cute cat photos, everything all at once in a jumble. That's not what people want. They want editorial license. They want somebody to select the things that go into the newspaper. But, of course, that means that there are certain things get blocked because they offend the sensibilities of the newspaper or they don't appear to be interesting to the owners of the newsletters. There's an interesting event that happened between Clint Eastwood and Michael Moore. He wrote 10 years ago this past week, and this was written a little while ago, so it's a little bit more than 10 years ago now. Clint Eastwood stood in front of the National Board of Review Awards Center and announced to me and to the crowd that he would kill me if I ever came to his house with my camera for an interview. "I'll kill you," he declared. The crowd laughed nervously. As for me, having just experienced a half dozen assaults in the previous year from crazies upset at Fahrenheit 9/11 and my anti-war Oscar speech, plus the attempt by a right-wing extremist to blow up my house, he was caught and went to prison. I was a bit stunned to hear Eastwood out of the blue make such a violent statement, but I instantly decided he was just trying to be funny, so I laughed the same nervous laugh everyone else did. Clint, though, didn't seem to like all that laughter. "I mean it," he barked, and the audience grew more quiet. "I'll shoot you." So this is freedom of speech, and I guess Clint Eastwood is entitled to say that, but there's two things we should say about it. First of all, I'm pretty sure that Clint Eastwood wouldn't kill Michael Moore if he came to his house, although I wouldn't suggest testing that hypothesis. But probably what's more important is that somebody else who hates Michael Moore might decide to do the job for Clint Eastwood, because Clint Eastwood has basically authorized that feeling. But should we censor Clint Eastwood for saying something that's quite hateful like that? It's not an easy question to answer. Another thing that's been in the news recently is that the government or the courts keep telling the Obama administration that they have to release pictures of American abuse of prisoners. These pictures are apparently extremely bad, showing sexual abuse, which ironically is somewhat similar to the Charlie Hebdo cartoons. The U.S. government has fought bitterly to prevent the publication of these photos. Of course, if the U.S. government really believed in freedom of speech as much as it says, then it would just have immediately published the photos and put them on the Internet and allow newspapers and magazines and television stations to decide which ones they wanted to show or not. But the government actually wants them hidden. Similarly, this is from a Guardian article, the government is making a similar argument in their efforts to keep secret Guantanamo force-feeding videos after multiple newspapers, including the Guardian, sued under the Freedom of Information Act to release the videos. So, again, freedom of speech. We should be able to see videos of prisoners being abused, whether it's by the American government or any other government, and whether that is sexual abuse or force feeding, we should be able to see and make up our own minds. And there is, I think, a real public interest, not just a prurient interest, in actually seeing what our governments are doing on our behalf, because public support for wars is generally retained by the sanitization of the war by minimizing what's shown in the press that could be upsetting to the delicate sensibilities of people who live in a country that's not at war like America or Canada or England. So I think that we can say when it comes to freedom of speech, there are limits, and there definitely are. I've mentioned some groups that we have legitimate reasons not to criticize. Jews were the butt of horrible stereotyping through the 19th century and the 20th century up till the Holocaust and the Second World War. And I think that we can say that what was written and drawn about Jews contributed to societal hatred of this identifiable group of people. Similar things can be said about black people. They came as slaves, and even when they were freed, they didn't have true freedom in America or in other places where they had been freed. And part of that was the stereotyping and demonization that occurred in print, both in writing and in drawing. Blacks were shown as lazy, sexually irresponsible. All the stereotypes were magnified. And in that context, the KKK and other groups like that could do their dirty work of harassing blacks, lynching them, just to keep the black population in line. And when the black civil rights movement finally got organized in the middle of the 20th century, it was a huge amount of violence against people who were just trying to peacefully demonstrate for the right to vote, for the right to have a cup of coffee sitting next to a white person in a restaurant. I am not advocating that we should go back to the time where Jewish stereotypes could be found routinely in newspaper cartoons or black stereotypes. But I also think we need to really carefully consider whether we should be stereotyping Muslims. If we're not going to allow certain groups to be criticized openly, why do we allow other groups? Going back to freedom of speech in France, recently a major French LGBT rights group called a significant victory when three people were convicted in a Paris court after they accompanied tweets with hashtags, including, this is a translation, "Let's burn the gays," or "Gays must die." So a hashtag saying we should kill gay people was forbidden. I think that indicates that there are limits on freedom of speech. We now have in California the rather sad spectacle of somebody trying to get on the ballot an initiative calling for the death of homosexual people in California. Obviously, this is illegal, even if the referendum was to pass, which is highly unlikely. It may probably won't even get enough signatures to get on the ballot, thank goodness. But even if it passed, it would not be legal. But that still legitimizes hatred against a particular group. On the other hand, if we get too concerned about this, we will be sending everybody to jail for even the most minor criticism of any identifiable group. In Germany, a judge ruled at the time of the Charlie Hebdo events that an anti-Israel activist incited hatred against Jews because of his calls to kill Zionists. So the judge said that Zionist, in the language of anti-Semites, is a code for a Jew. But actually, I think most people know that you can criticize the government of Israel, such as its current leader, Netanyahu, without being against Jews in general. And Zionism is basically the philosophy of recolonization of the Jewish homeland. And so you can be against Zionism without being against Jewish people, and you can be against Zionism without wanting to throw all the Jews in Israel into the sea. The judge didn't seem to understand these subtle differences. But again, it's an indication of the sensitivity of society to certain issues, and especially in Germany, which has obviously the history of the Holocaust, one can understand sensitivity towards anti-Jewish rhetoric, but that can get to the point where the Israeli government cannot be criticized because that might be considered to be anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic. Well, let's turn away from world politics and racism and all of those things. I recently interviewed a Texas researcher named Patricia Goodson because she published an article that just basically documented the fact that for the past 30 years, there have been very highly credentialed scientists who have criticized the HIV-AIDS theory. Her article didn't really take a side, although obviously by talking about dissidents or what the opponents or what the establishment calls denialists, just the mere fact of talking about dissidents of the HIV-AIDS theory is apparently taking a side. The journal Frontiers in Public Health was forced, very quickly forced, into doing an investigation. There's not really much information about the investigation, and I'm not too sure it was anything about thinking about how they were going to get themselves out of the pickle that they put themselves into. But they tried to be like King Solomon and cut the baby in half. And so they allowed psychology professor Seth Kalickman to write an article in opposition to the Patricia Goodson article, but they kept the Patricia Goodson article on the website, and it has had a huge number of views, many more than if it had been attacked. But clearly the point of the attack on the Patricia Goodson article was to silence Patricia Goodson by removing the article, or maybe not so much to silence Patricia Goodson, but to stifle discussion of the topic of whether HIV causes AIDS. So this is in America, which is the country which I think can be lauded for having the highest, putting the highest value in the world on freedom of speech. There's a lot of things you can say in America that you would not be able to say elsewhere. And so it's important to recognize that. But here in this country which values free speech, it's quite legitimate to say that not only are people who question the HIV-AIDS dogma wrong, but they should not be allowed to say it publicly. They should be prevented from publishing in the mainstream media. Check. You never see anything in the mainstream media that questions the HIV-AIDS hypothesis. Never is too strong a word. Maybe once a year you see a major article. At the same time, there's probably millions of articles that assume that the HIV-AIDS theory is correct. You should not be allowed to publish in the scientific media, in scientific journals, and that has almost been accomplished. The Patricia Goodson article was really quite unusual. It was interesting to read the Seth Kalickman article, because in response to a list of pretty factual information from Professor Goodson, Seth Kalickman went into a diatribe criticizing scientists who question the HIV-AIDS dogma, not because of their ideas, but because of strange things like the fact that Dr. Henry Bauer, former dean at Virginia Tech, has studied the Loch Ness Monster. But how do scientists decide that there's nothing to the Loch Ness Monster without studying it? If every scientist who decides he's going to study UFOs or psychic capabilities or the Loch Ness Monster, if every scientist who wants to study those things is ridiculed, then scientists can't actually have a position on those, because there will be no scientific facts. He criticized Dr. Peter Duisberg because Peter Duisberg discovered the first oncogene, which was believed to be a cancer-causing gene, and then later he decided that genes don't cause cancer. Something called aneuploidy causes cancer. And I interviewed, on that subject, I interviewed Dr. David Rasnick about the hypothesis that it's the wrong number of chromosomes in cells that causes them to be destabilized and become cancerous, not a problem with their genes, not mutations. I've always seen the criticisms of the HIV-AIDS theory as probably the most censored topic in science. But recently, I think that has been edged out by the discussion of vaccination. You are allowed to have as much discussion of vaccination as you want, as long as the discussion is completely pro-vaccination. And one of the things you're not allowed to say is that the opponents to vaccination in some cases are highly credentialed scientists and medical doctors. Recently, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, who knows a lot about vaccination, and everything I've written by her has been very calm, scientific, medically based, had planned a tour of Australia, and she had to cancel that tour. She blamed anti-free speech terrorists. That's what she's quoted of saying. It appears that there is a few things behind this latest opposition to discussing vaccination. There's been some bad press about vaccination. There was the whistleblower, the CDC whistleblower, who came out and said that, yes, we did manipulate studies in the early 1990s to cover up the fact that there was an association found between the MMR vaccines and autism. There are some whistleblowers at the Merck company, which produces the MMR vaccine, and those whistleblowers said that the effectiveness of the vaccine was overstated. This is of financially great significance, because if the vaccine is not as efficacious as the government requires, it cannot be sold for the purpose. So they have to achieve certain efficacy standards, and if they can't achieve them with the vaccine, well, then they have to apparently fake them, or at least that's what the whistleblowers are stating. In Canada, just before this whole measles outbreak came out, which, of course, measles is supposed to be prevented by the MMR vaccine, and the measles vaccine kind of became the poster child for what's so great about vaccines. Just before this, the Toronto Star, Canada's highest circulation daily newspaper, published an article on several girls who had become seriously disabled following an HPV vaccine. The newspaper was very careful to say that there was no proof that this was caused by the HPV vaccine. But when the whole measles vaccine censorship started to arise at about the same time, the Toronto Star was forced to backpedal and eventually retracted the article. Not that there was anything wrong with the article, but it dared to breathe that there might be a problem with the HPV vaccine. There was an article published that's also very controversial that was published in 2013 by some Canadian researchers, an article entitled Human Papillomavirus Vaccines as an Option for Preventing Cervical Malignancies, How Effective and Safe. There was an effort to get the University of British Columbia to deny these scientists. They're legitimate scientists who are very educated about neurology, ophthalmology, very concerned about the role of aluminum in the brain, and they have a devastating critique of the HPV vaccine, which appears to be totally based on scientific analysis of the trials. It doesn't just restrict itself to the science. It also notes in many cases the trials were funded and controlled by the manufacturers. I believe there's just two manufacturers of HPV vaccines. There's Merck that produces Gardasil, and GlaxoSmithKline approves Cervarix. So it's obviously in the best interest of the vaccine manufacturers if these vaccines can be seen as effective, as safe, and needed. But as this article points out, a number of interesting facts. One is that in developed countries, cervical cancer is very rare. In places where the PAPS screening is in place. They point out that if PAPS screening virtually eliminated cervical cancer, or at least reduced it to a very small percentage of what it used to be, if PAPS screening had that success, then maybe that should be done in developing countries, not this vaccine. They point out that in some ways the effectiveness of the vaccine has been greatly exaggerated. There are three stages of precancerous lesions, known as stages 1, 2, and 3. None of the three stages result in a guaranteed formation of a cancer. And in stage 1, it's extremely unlikely. Stage 2, it's very unlikely. And in stage 3, it's still only about a 50-50 chance. So one of the tricks that was done in the vaccine is they would put all three stages together. But since stage number 1 is most common, they could reduce the incidence of people achieving stage 1 precancerous lesions, knowing that the vast, vast majority of those lesions would regress without any adverse events. But the vaccine itself has been associated with a number of serious adverse events, including sudden deaths and sudden deaths and debilitating disorders. So, for example, out of 20,000 adverse events reported between 2006 and 2012 in the United States related to the HPV vaccine, out of 20,000, almost half required an emergency room visit. 581 people were permanently disabled. 348 were considered life-threatening. There were 73 deaths and 208 prolonged hospitalizations. They point out that in a country which has a very low rate of cervical cancer, that the risks from a vaccine, even if it's only 1 out of 100,000 people who get the vaccine who are damaged, the risk of the vaccine may still easily outweigh the benefits of reduction of cervical cancer. But what's even worse is that there is no evidence that the HPV vaccines will reduce cervical cancer. In the Nobel Prize citation for the human papilloma virus discovery, so a scientist, Harald Zurhausen, was given the Nobel Prize in 2008 for the discovery, supposedly HPV is associated with cervical cancer. It said in there quite explicitly, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, that it will be decades before we know whether the vaccines will actually reduce the risk of cervical cancer. What if it turns out that the vaccines do reduce the risk of cervical cancer, but it's only maybe by 25%, not by the 70% that is believed to be the case? And there's reasons to believe that it will be much less than the effectiveness that's being touted in the absence of any evidence. This will mean that a very small number of lives are saved, but at the same time, we see that a fairly large number of deaths are occurring, and you know, permanently disabled is as serious in many ways as a death. I mean, perhaps in some ways more serious. I mean, if you are a parent who loses a child after a vaccination, you mourn, and hopefully you can recover and go on with your life. But if your child is permanently disabled, you not only have to look after the child 24 hours a day, but you also have to worry about what's going to happen to your child after you are too old to look after them or you die. I think that must be a trauma that, as a parent, it's very hard for me to imagine as a parent of three healthy children. This all does relate to freedom of speech, because we should be able to talk about these issues. We should be able to question the effectiveness of a vaccine. But what's actually happening is there are more and more people calling for mandatory vaccination. And part of calling for mandatory vaccination is you have to eliminate freedom of speech on the vaccination issue. Because if people can start talking about vaccination, there's a lot of vaccines that become quite obviously not really that useful and have fairly serious dangers. Hepatitis B is a good example, HPV, which I've just talked about. The flu vaccine, it was recently shown that this year the flu vaccine was actually of negative effectiveness if you'd also had the flu vaccine last year. In other words, if you had the flu vaccine 2 years in a row, you were more likely to get the flu. But even putting that aside, the actual effectiveness against this year's flu was extremely low. I saw 3% cited. So a few people may be saved from getting the flu, but millions of people will be injected with mercury, which is in most flu vaccines, and will be injected with all the other components of the flu vaccine. Flu is vaccine is grown on eggs, so somebody who has a previously unidentified egg allergy may have a serious adverse reaction and may die just from that aspect of the vaccine. So we can all support freedom of speech until it butts up against powerful industrial interests. If the vaccines are criticized, the acceptance of the HPV vaccine could drop, and then the profits of Merck and GlaxoSmithKline drop. And the current projections for vaccines is that they're going to rise in sales in the United States from about $12 billion in 2012 to about $17 or $18 billion by 2018. But that implies that more and more people are taking more and more vaccines. So every time some people say, well, we need some vaccines, but not all, that has a serious hit on the profits of pharmaceutical companies, which seems to be more important than the actual health of the population. The pharmaceutical companies are caught into a trap of growth. In order to make more and more profits every year, they have to get more and more people to take more drugs, more vaccines, or the other products that they produce. And if people start turning around and saying, you know, this is not making me healthier, maybe there's a lot of benefits to doing nothing and focusing on my diet, exercise, stress levels, all of those kinds of things, things that take no pharmaceutical interventions, that could destroy the profits of pharmaceutical companies. While we're on freedom of speech, I'd like to go back to the case which I mentioned some time ago, which is of the Dalhousie dental students. Now, there were a group of male dental students at Dalhousie University in Canada who had a private Facebook group, and on that, they were being dumb young male students a lot of the time, but they crossed the line in a sense when they made a couple of postings, one of which put up pictures of students in their class and asked which student the other dental students in the group would like to hate, and then the F word. Now, in their defense, this was a private discussion, and it became public when somebody got upset by what they saw and leaked it to the press. That's not to defend what they said. Obviously, it's unconscionable. The question is, what do you do about it? Now, in our punishment-oriented world, there were a lot of calls for them to be thrown out of university. This was basically at the end of their studies, so after about 3.5 years of dental studies, they were going to be thrown out onto the street and they would never be able to work as dentists in the future. And what would that actually do to the cause of getting men to respect women more? You'd have a bunch of really angry men who are now going to be working low-paying jobs instead of what they had expected to do to get a high-paying job as a dentist. So the university did what I think was probably one of the most enlightened things possible. They started a process of what they called restorative justice. I also talked about this a little bit on an earlier podcast. So basically, restorative justice means that the people who've been accused of doing something bad, these male dentistry students, sit around with the people whose lives they have affected, in this case, the women in their same class who they had named in some of these nasty postings on Facebook. There were some criticisms of this, but it seemed to come from some professors in the university and from some outsiders who just wanted to make sure that when men did something bad against women that they would be punished visibly. And they believe that if you make an example of a few men, that will reform all men. Unfortunately, this attitude towards punishing a few and getting everybody to wake up really doesn't work. So the restorative justice process is that basically everybody sits around the table, and the women, young women who were affected, get to explain why they were hurt by what happened, and the men who wrote these things get to think about this and to then start to indicate that they understand the hurt, that they're sorry, and the group as a whole can start to think about what can be done about this. What can happen out of a process like this, I think, is that the men can realize that what they did was wrong. The women can evaluate this and can determine that they're actually sincere in their turnabout, in their attitudes. And perhaps everybody out of this process can have a better understanding of the opposite sex and more respect. So it is actually a very successful process. It saved the careers of the men. The women actually indicated that they were upset that they were separated from the men, because even though the men had said these hateful things in secret behind the backs of these women, and once it came out, the women were quite hurt, they still liked the men, and they wanted to continue to be with them in their dentistry classes. This applies to the issue of freedom of speech. I guess I should have got there first, because what the man actually said compared to some of the things in Charlie Hebdo is not really any more severe. I mean, they were talking about individuals as opposed to insulting the God of a billion people. It seems like a very philosophical discussion about, you know, which is worse, to insult somebody's religion or to individually insult somebody in a sexually crude way. But the point is that the response of the university was to get the young men to take ownership of the problem, to put the people who were affected in charge, and through a process of consensus, come out with a solution. Canadian media seemed very skeptical of this. They really wanted to see some people hanging in the public square. They'd love to see these boys working at McDonald's, cleaning the floor, you know, when before they were this soon-to-be dentist earning over $100,000 a year. But really, when you think about it, the process accomplished a lot of goals about getting to a better and more open discourse about things that especially young people have a lot of trouble talking about. A lot of young men have a lot of trouble talking about their sexuality, just like young women, and don't really know how to deal with it. And I think a process like this can really help everybody get to a better place of being able to talk about what's appropriate, what's inappropriate, about sexuality, how to have a good time without, denigrating somebody as part of that. And I think usually when you can understand people's feelings, you can be a lot more sensitive. And maybe if we had more white Christians trying to talk to dark-skinned Muslims, trying to understand each other's religions, each other's outlooks, we would all understand that we're actually a lot closer together than the people who try to divide us try to make out. and we would end up in a better place where we could have freedom of speech, but also a feeling that those who speak have a responsibility to try to understand people, that if you're going to tell jokes, it should be with some sensitivity towards the other person and not trying to get cheap laughs by insulting and belittling people, whether they're Muslims or Jews or blacks or women or men or whoever. We should all be more sensitive to each other's humanity. So I would love to hear from you about this discussion of freedom of speech and the various aspects of our society that affects war and peace, politics, sexuality, medicine. Freedom of speech is important. It is not a Manichaean issue, which is a fancy word for saying it's not a black and white issue. You cannot have total freedom of speech, and even in the most stifling regimes in the world, there was never an absence of freedom of speech because people always find a way to express themselves. I would really like to thank you for listening to another episode of The Infectious Myth. I really appreciate any comments that come my way. Whether you have criticisms of the show, just want to say that you like listening to it. If you have suggestions for future guests, I've had a lot of those suggestions, and many of the guests I've already had have come from suggestions from listeners, and I'd like to keep this going. If you read a great book and you think that the author would make a good guest on the show, let me know. I like to cover, obviously, a lot of scientific issues, especially medical science, but also politics, human sexuality, sexual relations, things like that. I like to cover issues that I haven't yet covered. So I'd just like to thank everybody for listening, and stay tuned for another episode of The Infectious Myth next week.